very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Ferdinando Sardella from the University of Uppsala, or Uppsala, depending on where you come from. And he's a research fellow here at the centre, and he teaches and researches in Uppsala University, particularly on the history of Vaishnavism, really. And he had he did his PhD about 5 years ago now, it must be, was it?
2010.
And indeed, was awarded a prize for the best thesis for that piece of work. And it's now published as a book, Modern Hindu Personalism, The History, Life and Thought of Bhaktivedanta Sarasvati.
Bhaktisiddhanta,
published by OUP, so you can buy it in the bookshop, local bookshop there. And today he's going to speak to us about Hinduism and globalization. So, Dr. Sardella.
Thank you, Professor Flood, Shyama Karishi, and the Oxford Center for Indo Studies for allowing me to come and speak today. I will speak about some empirical work that I carried out in 2011 and 12. Parts of this work reflect one of my research interests, that is writing a genealogy or a history of Bengali or Gaudiya Vaishnavism in the modern period. Part of it reflects also my broader interest for exploring the genealogy of global or transnational Hinduism, with particular focus on Europe and India. This is a work in progress, part of my postdoctoral program at the University of Uppsala in Swedish, financed by the Swedish Research Council. The project is called Hinduism and Globalization, a Return Journey, and deals with a religious movement from Bengal, the Gaudiya Math, which transmigrated from India to Sweden in the 1940s through European converts, before the Hindu diaspora reached there. This presentation touches on some aspect of that history. At this stage, I'm very grateful for any suggestions or feedback from the seminar about the issues discussed below. Hinduism, as we know, is a pluralistic religion or religious culture that escapes essentialist definitions. At the same time, we can see certain currents of thought that have more influence and impact than others. For instance, what is now labeled as modern Hinduism, that is the particular currents of thought that emerged during the colonial period through the agency of the Hindu middle class, a precursor of global Hinduism in some ways, has, as it is well known, a leaning towards Advaita Vedanta. This is historically traceable in the thought of figures like Ram Mohan Roy, Swami Vivekananda, Professor Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, to cite a few of the most well-known examples. Beside leading intellectuals with a structured approach, sampradayas, and various religious institutions, Hinduism takes many other forms which may or may not have a clear structure of theological thought. That is not to say that one is better than the other, but it just reflects the rich variety found within Hinduism. I will not try here to define what globalization is, but for the purpose of this topic, globalization within Hinduism will refer to the process of internationalization and religious deterritorialization through migration and transnational institutions occurring from the late 19th century to the present. In the first part, I will briefly discuss Hindu pluralism, above all in relation to the migration of Hindus to Sweden, highlighting varieties and diversities both in institutional and non-institutional settings. I will discuss some of the challenges that the diaspora have met in Northern Europe and how it copes with issues of identity, visibility, and integration. In the second part, I address the foreign immigration to India of Bengal Vaishnavas from various parts of the world, and the growing international settlement in Mayapur, north of Calcutta in West Bengal. My main concern here is not the international settlement itself, but how it is perceived by locals, Hindus and Muslims alike. Here, too, issues of integration, visibility, and identity will be discussed. Hinduism in Sweden consists of communities and individuals segmented according to ethnic, linguistic, and cultural borders. It is visible through temples and shrines, newly established guru movements, and the widespread practice of yoga. So I will explain that a little further now. Four groups of diaspora Hindus have migrated to Sweden. The first consists of well-educated peoples who settled in the 1950s and 60s. The second consists of so-called Uganda Indians within Gujarat who were expelled by dictator Idi Amin and arrived to Sweden in 1972 and 73. The third group is represented by Tamils who fled the 1983 to 2009 civil war in Sri Lanka. The fourth group is the outcome of a new wave of South Asian immigration. Students, whose number though have decreased after university fees were introduced in Sweden in 2011, engineers and information technologists. The last group consists of immigrants who first came to study and work in Sweden and later decided to settle down. A significant number of diaspora Hindus have also immigrated on account of family ties. Hindus in Sweden are found in large urban areas across the country, but Gujaratis from East Africa have tended to concentrate in the southwest, while Tamils and Bengalis are mostly concentrated in the Stockholm region. The most prominent diaspora shrines in Sweden are the following. Here comes a little list. The Hindu Union in Jönköping, the Sri Svaminaraya Mandir and Hindu Mandal in Mariestad, the Hindu Mandir in Borås, the Hindu Mandal in Trollhättan. In the Stockholm region, there is the Hindu Mandir in Sollentuna and the Sweden Ganesh Temple in Farsta. There are also religious associations such as Svadhyay Paribar Sweden and the association Shanatani in Uppsala. Bangla-speaking Hindus with roots in India and Bangladesh organize in Stockholm festivals such as Durga Puja through the Bongyo Shanatan Samaj. At pan-Hindu shrines such as the Hindu Mandir in Sollentuna and Hindu Mandal in Mariestad, images from different traditions such as Vaishnavism, Shaivism and Shaktism are worshipped side by side. The Sri Svaminarayan Mandir in Mariestad, on the other hand, is a shrine run by the well-known Gujarati Vaishnava movement. It is difficult to assess the number of diaspora Hindus in Sweden, since a systematic census of religious affiliation has not yet been conducted. As such, any estimate can only be tentative. Compared to Norway, where the majority of diaspora Hindus come from Sri Lanka, the majority of Hindus in Sweden are of Indian origin. In 2011, there were 18,600 persons born in India, 6,700 from Sri Lanka, 6,500 from Bangladesh, of which some portion are Hindus, about 700 born in Nepal. These figures exclude those outside of South Asia, born outside of South Asia, but includes a large number of adopted children. Considering that Hindus compose approximately 80% of the Indian population, the total figure of 10 to 12,000 diaspora Hindus seems quite reasonable. This figure includes those who are members of Hindu organizations and shrines, those who are not, and those who are culturally but not religiously active. About 1,000 Swedes and other Europeans are directly or indirectly linked to Hindu organizations and institutions. The Hindu diaspora communities have created umbrella organizations such as the Hindu Association in Sweden, Hinduiska Samfundet i Sverige in Swedish, which was registered in 2001 after a new law about religious institutions was passed, but it is now inactive. In the early 1990s, the Vishva Hindu Parishad in Bromma, near Stockholm, attempted to create an umbrella organization, but that effort was also discontinued. The major obstacles for these initiatives have been the distribution of funds, how to distribute the funds, and the diversity of the communities involved. The Swedish Indians Association, SIA, however, is an active watchdog organization that works for social and cultural integration. It monitors government policies and consumer products in order to safeguard the interests of the Hindu community. The SIA has acted in the case of a Scandinavian airline magazine that advertised vodka along with an image of Goddess Kali. In another instance, the SIA filed a complaint against a Swedish company that sold sandals decorated with the image of Goddess Lakshmi. Important features of Hindu religiosity among South Asians are, among others, devotion or bhakti and the performance of puja. A puja room with an altar and a set of sacred images is often found in private homes in Sweden, and families regularly meet for worship, prayers, and readings of religious texts. In the temples, homage to images, darshan, joint singing, and partaking of sanctified food, prasad, are regularly practiced. What follows is a closer description of some of the main shrines. Tamil-speaking Hindus from South India and Sri Lanka have a Tamil shrine in Stockholm, while North Indians have a temple called Hindu Mandir, where services in Hindi and Sanskrit are held. The Tamil shrine is dedicated to Ganesh, also known as Vinayaka or Ganapati. The Hindu culture maintained center that runs the temple was created in 1999. In the year 2000, a temple was created in Tallkrogen, a suburb of Stockholm, but later moved to a more spacious facility in nearby Farsta. In 2008, after a comprehensive renovation, the installation ceremony of the images of Ganesh, Shiva, Parvati, Lakshmi, Murukan, Skanda, and the Navagrahas, the personified images of the lunar nodes and the seven planets, took place and lasted for 4 days. The new temple is inspired by the Bhakti, or in Tamil, Patti tradition of Shaiva Siddhanta, which is theologically close to monism or non-dualism, but also maintains a distinction between God and the self. The temple is run according to an inclusive understanding of Shaiva and Ganesh Bhakti. About 150 persons regularly participate in the temple programs, which are carried out on Tuesday, Fridays, and festive days. The standard temple schedule consists of bathing the images, abhishek, puja, and sharing sanctified food, prasad, often sponsored by the community. As the name Hindu Culture Maintain Center suggests, the shrine was created for the purpose of preserving Hindu values and culture for present and future generations. On Saturdays, there is a Hindu school with classes in Tamil, where children sing and learn about religious texts. In December each year, there is an event that features Bharatanatyam, a classical temple dance from Tamil Nadu. Gender and caste distinction are not overly visible in the community, except in the case of the priest, a pujari, who is a male Brahmin. A woman plays an important role in the temple rituals by leading the singing of prayers. The Tamil minority is generally well integrating in Sweden. Since the civil war ended in 2009, Sri Lankan Tamils are regularly visit Sri Lanka and maintain close relations with their relatives. A congregation of the Swedish church rents out the temple premises to the Tamil Association, and relations between the communities have been cordial. Through the years, a number of Swedes have approached the temple administrations to learn how to perform puja at home. The Hindu Mandir in Sollentuna is located in a suburb north of Stockholm and was acquired in 1998. It hosts images of Radha and Krishna, Hanuman, Ganesh, Sita and Ram, and is also partly dedicated to the Shakta goddess Vaishno Devi, whose main shrine is in Kashmir. During puja, devotional prayers are sung in Hindi and Sanskrit, and on Sundays the local priest offers lectures on Hindu texts, which is not done in the Tamil temple. The shrine performs aarti every morning and evening at 7 o'clock and ritually maintains a broad ecumenical profile. It celebrates the anniversary of prominent South Asian religious figures such as the Buddha and Guru Nanak. The Hindu Mandir is around 400 paying members and families, and they're the one who have become more active, trying to unify and creating umbrella organizations for the Hindus in Sweden. The Gujaratis who arrived to Sweden from Uganda have settled in cities like, as I mentioned, Jönköping, Borås, Trollhättan, and Mariestad in the west of the country, where small to large businesses have offered them employment. In 1974, the Hindu Union in Jönköping was started, and at the end of 1970s, the Hindu Society was inaugurated in Trollhättan, a town with a long tradition of car manufacturing and industrial engineering. In Mariestad, the Hindu population counts more than 200 individuals. There is a Swaminarayan temple and an association called Hindu Mandal with no institutional affiliations. The anthropologist Hall has argued that since Uganda Hindus arrive at the same time and are small in number, they have neither pronounced caste structures nor hierarchies based on the length of their settlement. Compared to Britain, Gujarati Hindus have been more successful in reaching middle-class status and in acquiring properties and homes, she suggests. It is difficult to distinguish today their social status from that of average middle-class Swedes. On the other hand, due to their small numbers, their identity and cultural presence are not as pronounced as in the case of Britain. Hall has suggested that second- and third-generation Hindus from this community tend to have less contact with India and see themselves more as Swedish Indians rather than Gujarati Hindus. The Swaminarayan Temple was created on larger premises that earlier hosted the Kingdom Hall of the Jehovah's Witnesses, while the Hindu Mandal Temple is located in a basement. In Trollhättan, Borås, and Jönköping, shrines have similarly been created in rented flats and basements nearby diaspora neighborhoods. In these and occasionally larger rented facilities, Hindu festivals such as Holi, Diwali, Raksha Bandhan, and Navratri are regularly observed. Hinduism in Sweden includes Western converts and sympathizers of so-called guru movements, such as Osho. To these also belong the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and Vrinda, which are Bengali or Gaudiya Vaishnava institutions. Vrinda runs a temple and a vegetarian restaurant in Gothenburg. In Sweden, it's quite popular with vegetarian restaurants. The prototype of the two latter movement is the Gaudiya Math, an ashram that was inaugurated in Calcutta in 1918 by the Guru Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. The Gaudiya Math itself has historical roots in Radha and Krishna Bhakti and the Bengali mystic Chaitanya. ISKCON temples offer traditional temple services that include puja, prasad, songs, and lectures on texts such as the Bhagavad Gita, which partially explains their popularity in mainstream India today, in the temples in India. The number of sympathizers of ISKCON in Sweden is hard to count, but I estimate around 1,000 to 2,000 people. The society runs three temple communities in the Stockholm area, which with about 120 residents and a number of active participants at various levels of commitment. The first of the temple communities is Anviks Gård, a farm near Järna in the southwest of Stockholm with 65 residents. The second is Korsnäs Gård near Tumba, which has Radha Krishna images and an international publishing house for Vaishnava literature. At Fridhemsplan in central Stockholm, there is the Hare Krishna Center with a temple, a shop, and an attached vegetarian restaurant, which serves prasad to the public. To Fridhemsplan is attached a house in Bromma, nearby central Stockholm, with about 30 residents. ISKCON has also a temple with an attached vegetarian restaurant in Gothenburg and Lund, and it runs a small center in Malmö in the south near Copenhagen. Active participants are, for the most part, Swedes and Westerners from all parts of Europe, and to a limited degree, Indians. The largest concentration of Swedish-born participants is found in the rural community at Anviks Gård, which has earlier hosted the only Hindu primary school in the country. Thus far, the relation between ISKCON participants and the Hindu diaspora in Sweden has been different from the experience of Great Britain and North America, where diaspora Hindus and Westerners have closely integrated. Differences in ritual practice, ethnic background, ritual language, and selection of images, for example, images of Chaitanya are not well known outside of Bengal, have contributed to the divide, although South Asians do occasionally visit ISKCON shrines. The relation between ISKCON participants and Gujaratis in West Sweden, in contrast, has been more cordial. One reason is that most Gujaratis are quite familiar with Vaishnavism and share with ISKCON a common religious framework. In Gothenburg, funeral rites, anniversaries, marriages, and ritual services have been regularly carried out by the local ISKCON temple on behalf of the diaspora community. Other Hindu guru movements have a visible presence in Sweden. These movements include the Transcendental Meditation, the Brahma Kumaris in Stockholm, Bhagavan Rajneesh or Osho, Ananda Marga in Udrefors, there is a farm, the Art of Living, and the Scandinavian Yoga and Meditation School. They are linked to the Hindu diaspora is, however, restricted due to the fact that traditional temple rituals are not emphasized. Their target, instead, is the practice of another Hindu influence in the West, which is modern yoga. Let me say a few words about that. In 1949, Shyam Sundar Goswami, a Bengali from the Nadia district, whose family background is linked to the Chaitanya tradition, opened the first yoga center in Scandinavia, the Goswami Yoga Institute in Stockholm, with the help of Karin Schalander. Shyam Sundar Goswami had worked with physical yoga for many years before he was invited to represent India at the Lingayatan World Congress for Physical Education, which was held in connection with international competitions of the Swedish Gymnastics Federation. His teachings were based on Kundalini Yoga, a practice related to Tantra that has become particularly popular in Sweden. Kundalini Yoga, as well known, is based on an anatomy of energy channels with centers or chakra, running vertically through the body. Modern yoga in Sweden emphasizes bodily exercises, but often combines them with recitation of mantra and meditation. Yoga teachers such as Krishnamacharya and his disciple Padavi Joyce and Iyengar, Desikachar, Shivananda Sarasvati and his disciple Swami Satyananda Sarasvati, and Yogi Bhajan have played important roles in the spreading of various forms of yoga in Sweden. Yoga centers offer a wide range of courses, most often with a clear profile toward health and well-being. Institutes such as MediYoga have introduced yoga as a medicine in hospitals and contributed to research on yoga's clinical effects in cooperation with prominent medical institutions such as Karolinska Institutet and Danderyd Sjukhus Hospital. In Sweden, an estimated 400,000 persons practice some form of yoga in gyms, yoga school, healthcare centers, hospitals, and businesses. A few hundred articles are written in Swedish media every year about the positive impact of yoga on physical and mental health. Swedes visit India for retreats and receive advanced training from experienced yoga teachers, but they tend to view yoga as a physical and mental practice rather than a discipline integrated with a religious path, although there is a pronounced interest for understanding the theoretical roots of yoga. A number of yoga trainees sympathize with Hindu concepts such as karma and reincarnation. Diaspora Hindus are generally well integrating in Sweden in terms of education and employment, although they presently have a low representation at the political level, a condition which they share with South Asians at large. Contributing to their high level of integration is the widespread perception that Hinduism at heart is a tolerant religion that does not oppose pluralism and democracy. Hinduism is less frequently covered, though, in media compared to Islam and Judaism. Guru movements, on the contrary, have generated more interest, although this interest from the media has been somewhat mixed with suspicion and fear. The diaspora and the SIA that we mentioned earlier, on several occasions has expressed the concern that the presentation of Hinduism in public schools and in the media is biased and one-sided. For example, it is often stated that most Hindus believe in many gods rather than in one god with many forms or no form. Representations of Hinduism, according to this view, have tended to be monolithic and focus on social issues such as caste and the status of women, rather than on more egalitarian currents such as Bhakti, contemporary Hindu thought, or the pluralism of modern Hinduism. Let us now turn to one institutional example of global Hinduism in India, that is the Hare Krishna movement, which has emerged in the West from the North American and European counterculture of the 1960s and 70s, and established its first center in Sweden in 1973 in central Stockholm. I will not explore the roots of this modern movement found in West Bengal during the colonial period, which I have done elsewhere in this book. But I will briefly follow its recent return to its geographical roots, that is Mayapur and Navadvip, in West Bengal, where the leading figure that inspired the movement, that is Chaitanya, was born in 1486. The town of Navadvip is located in the Nadia district on the western shore of one of the branches of the Ganges, called the Hooghly, that flows to Kolkata approximately 130 kilometers south. From the 13th to the end of the 18th century, Navadvip gradually rose in public renown, not only for being a major center of Hindu philosophy, above all in New Nyaya or Navanyaya in Bengali. The British later called Navadvip even the Oxford of India, but also for being the birthplace of Chaitanya. The population of Navadvip stands at approximately 115,000 residents, most of whom are followers of either the Vaishnava or the Shakta tradition, and in many cases, of both. Navadvip is regarded as the heart of the Chaitanya Vaishnava communities of eastern India and Bangladesh, and thousands of pilgrims visit it daily. The town hosts major temple structures, which usually contain resident quarters for ascetics, called Babajis, and itinerant pilgrims. It has one of two birthplaces of Chaitanya called Prachin Mayapur or Old Mayapur. The Gaudiya Math and its predecessors firmly contested the location of the birthplace in Navadvip, resulting in the development of a new birthplace on the Mayapur side called Yogapit. In the 1970s, the founder of ISKCON, Abhay Charan Aravinda Deya, later known by his monastic name Bhaktivedanta Swami, acquired a plot of land in Mayapur just a few hundred meters from the Yogapit and began to develop a religious community now spread across the area. It counts today about 2,200 foreigners and approximately 2,000 Bengali and Indian devotees, plus hundreds of employees from the nearby Muslim and Hindu farming villages. From the outset, it appears that this development has not been well received by Navadvip's Vaishnavas, who have previously contested the authenticity of the Mayapur birth site, while firmly upholding the validity of their own, but this is only half the truth. Bhaktivedanta wished Mayapur to become a model for the Chaitanyaite world, and he envisioned a large temple that would attract residents, pilgrims, and large crowds of religious tourists. A large Hindu temple is presently under construction, and its completion is tentatively scheduled for 2016 and 17. Unsure, but more or less. The financial input of ISKCON in this remote rural area of Bengal has stimulated a number of social and economic transformations, from new employment opportunities to rapid increase of land prices that has made many of the local land owners, especially the Muslim peasants, very wealthy. Fieldwork interviews and participant observation conducted by me in the area in 2012 has resulted in the following preliminary observations. The community of the Hare Krishnas, in Mayapur is no longer specifically Indian or Bengali. The majority consists of a number of citizens from Europe, North America, and Russia. Peoples from China and South America have also become visible. Among the local Hindu and Muslim population in Mayapur, the foreigners are seen from time to time as alien or with suspicion due to the colonial past. Rumors of involvement with American intelligence have circulated since the 1970s and have been propagated, among others, by Marxist members of the Communist Party of India. Despite these challenges, the situation in Mayapur appears to have advantages for Indians and non-Indians alike. Bengali and Indian Hindus who support the international movement appear to derive authority and prestige from it and legitimize the importance and significance of their religion from its international growth. Hindus appear to be acquiring a new sense of pride by witnessing how Westerners, Chinese, and others are practicing local religious traditions, albeit in a new tapping, giving them a new sense of identity and even hope, and inspiring them to take their own religion and culture somewhat more seriously, as a side effect of globalization. The foreign Vaishnavas, on the other side, gain from closeness to the source of their faith, from contact with the traditional settings in which Chaitanya Vaishnavism was born and grown, and from sharing a sacred space that, according to Vaishnava theology, can open the doors to eternal life. I've conducted interviews in temple and shrines in Navadvip, and the preliminary assessment is that the rate of approval of foreign Hindus is about 50 to 60% among the Vaishnavas. Many appreciate the seriousness and sincerity of the foreigners, that some find supportive to their own religion and culture, and the fact that foreigners attract more tourists and pilgrims, which results in more investments and more jobs. Critics resent the fact that foreigners seem to appropriate their own religion, possibly a new form of colonialism in disguise, the fact that the whites have brought unnecessary wealth through international funding, which some perceive as a threat to the simple lifestyle of traditional Vaishnavism in Bengal. Moral and ethics is also an issue, since white and other foreign Hindus are perceived as more liberal and casual about codes of conduct. A last point of contention is that prices from food to building materials to land has considerably increased due to the foreigners. The tendency, nonetheless, is that non-Indian Hindus become more accepted as time goes by, and some of the pandits and temple owners that I interviewed were ready to give in marriage their daughters to a sincere practice in Vaishnava from any nationality, although this is generally not encouraged. The situation is slightly different in Kolkata, where foreign Hindus are treated by the local Hindu middle class with open sympathy. At the Durga Puja in 2012, there were several pandals portraying the design of the upcoming temple in Mayapur. In June 2012, during the annual Ratha Yatra organized by the Hare Krishnas in Kolkata, the Chief Minister of West Bengal, Mamata Banerjee, humbly offered her respects to an ISKCON American guru, Jayapataka Swami. So, just some concluding remarks. Mirananda has suggested that the neoliberalism and the strive for economic developments in India does not appear to constitute a threat to religion and Hinduism as such, but instead it enforces it. According to her, globalization provides a false feeling of security and homogeneity, and a belief that local religious forms can become assimilated and domesticated. According to Nanda, on the other hand, this is an illusion. Since fundamentalism is on the rise all the while, secularism is being redefined in terms of a greater tolerance of religions in public space. This does not appear to apply to the situation on the ground observed in Bengal after the fall of the Communist Party, although the strengthening of Hinduism in West Bengal, following the economic development of the Hindu middle class, may pose challenges to Hindu and Muslim relations later on. Scholars like Anita Bhela have also voiced some concern regarding global Hinduism among the middle class in India and abroad. The world of Hinduism, she maintains, nourished by television, cartoons, internet, and computer games, has diminished the role of practice and active participation in ritual events. Hinduism is on the rise in India, true enough, but is also being commodified and packaged for consumption by a wealthy and influential middle class that is religiously inquisitive. One interesting element of globalization is that race and ethnicity do not appear to matter as much as before. Foreign Hindus are influential in India, and some are widely accepted by the Hindu community. American gurus among the Hare Krishnas have in some cases thousands of well-off Indian disciples from Mumbai and Kolkata. White Hindus in particular appear to have become a showcase of the universal nature of Hindu values and practice, a source of pride and legitimation. To this, however, it must be added that, at least in the case of Mayapur, foreign Hindus often lack knowledge of Indian languages and are so far not well integrated in the local communities and local economy. Most foreign residents in resident Vaishnavas are, in fact, heavily dependent on foreign funding from home. In contrast, the Hindu diaspora in Sweden is well integrated, has good competence in the Swedish language, and its religious practices have rarely caused controversy, despite the fact that foreign immigration is today, as in other countries in Europe, become a disputed issue in Sweden. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Well, we've got 25 minutes of discussion and questions. So Ken.
Very nice. I was just thinking about your interviews in Navadvip. You conducted them yourself, I presume?
No, actually, I didn't. Some of them I did myself. Uh-huh. But I thought that it would be more interesting, in one sense, if I had some Bengalis doing uh-huh. the interviews.
Okay, that was kind of my question.
Yeah.
If you're interviewing, you'll get a certain kind of response.
Yeah, exactly.
Local is interviewing.
Yeah.
Really
it would have been a little bit too... I think it would have created a kind of bias if I would have done all of them myself. So what I did, I cooperate with Jadavpur University in Calcutta, mm-hmm. and I coordinating a team that went to certain of the shrines and did the interviews mm-hmm. with Bengali speaking, with Bengalis. And then I conducted my own interviews and at times went back to the same places and got another feedback.
So you did get different responses? From some, I mean, did you meet then some of the same people they met? And
yeah, in some cases, I didn't find a great divergence, though. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, I did. In other cases, I just went to other and cover other areas of Navadvip to get a diversified response.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in this reversal. You've got the Bengali Hindus in origin coming to Sweden and being well integrated into the society, and the Western Hindus going to Bengal and not integrating.
they're too lazy to learn the language.
Is that what it is?
And the
suspicion of the Bengalis that it's a new kind of colonialism. I think I've got some sympathy with that.
It did seem like that to me as well. It's like they're coming and they've adopted something of Bengali culture, but not really.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the ones going to the West just get on with it, get into it, become part of the scene, because that's what you do, because they have regard. But it seems like, it does seem like they don't have the same regard, which is the colonial thing.
Mm.
Yes, that's true. I also think it has to do a little bit with the purpose of this kind of emigration, because like Bengalis going to Sweden or in the West, they go there for some economic opportunities or education, so it's crucial for them to integrate, be part of the society for financial, social, cultural,
yeah.
political reasons, or even just to stay there and get resident permits. While Westerners in India, they come there for more spiritual motives and stay confined in certain sacred spaces. And in that situation, with funding from abroad, they don't feel the necessity really to integrate. There is no like the motivation is not strong enough. Mm-hmm. Although I do notice that those who stay there, like for longer periods of time, they feel kind of handicapped if they don't really learn the language and kind of understand the cultural codes of the Indians. And there are issues of cultural misunderstandings and conflicts because of the foreigners not really understanding cultural behavior of the Bengalis. Mm. So, yeah, it's quite a complex situation.
So is that a clash of values or is it a clash of something else?
Well, it could be a clash of values. It could be a clash of ownership. This is a very Navadvip is a very ancient city. It has a recorded history of more than 1,000 years. So the pandits and the, even the Vaishnavas who live there, they have a very strong sense of ownership, like that. Mm. So the foreigners they have to negotiate that their place, their space, like that, and it's not a given. Mm. And then the idea of colonialism, I think is still. still there in the background. Although things are changing, basically through interactions, like sharing the same kind of spaces, Indians, Bengalis go into the foreigner settlements. I conducted also surveys among the pilgrims, the visitors. Emerges that they have some appreciation of the kind of international environment that Hare Krishna created there. It's clean and it's different. It has a certain attractive features to it. Especially the young generation, both Hindu and Muslims, like very much to visit these places. And so there is a kind of natural interaction taking place because of sharing the same kind of space. Mm. And things are being negotiated, but it's slow. Mm. It's not happening overnight.
And it was interesting that people are sometimes happy to marry their children within the Vaishnava community, but outside of the traditional boundaries of family or whatever. You know. So, is that because Vaishnava initiation eradicates caste?
The Vaishnavas on the Navadvip side are kind of diversified. There are those who are belong to very traditional caste-oriented families. Mm. With very strong hereditary ritual rites that have been transmitted through centuries. Mm. For them, it's an issue. Mm. While they're also low-caste Vaishnavas living there, for them, it doesn't really matter. So I was kind of surprised when I talked to these pandits, which are coming from very established families with very strong traditions. And one of them were telling me that he was ready to marry his daughter to a foreign Vaishnava. I was kind of very surprised. Mm. But it's kind of an indication of things changing there. Mm. Even a few years ago, that would have been impossible.
Mm. But is that linked to economic improvement? There would be, you know, the chance for travel, perhaps to go to America. And, my experience of it, that there's an element of that involved also. Yeah.
Could be. Although my experience of the kind of the pandit world of Navadvip is that they're kind of proud of their culture. And many of their children, the problem there is many of their children do actually move from there and kind of go to foreign countries. And like in some temples, the son will be working in Mumbai, the daughter will be married in Switzerland, and they would question how we'd be able to maintain the pujas and the temple traditions in the next generation. So it seems like they're facing a breaking point in their history, where the opportunities now are increasing in Bengal. It's possible to get a good education and get admitted to university and schools in Delhi and Mumbai. at the same time, I've seen also cases where the children have gone to get educated and get a degree and then come back and become pujaris in the temple of their parents just to continue the tradition. So I found both things, that there is, as you said, an incitement for economic development. At the same time, there are also others who see a value in building up, rebuilding, or stopping the decay of Navadvip. And like that. So I think it's both ways, I would say. Yes?
You're probably familiar with this study that was done in Vrindavan in, I guess, the early 80s. Was it Charles Brooks, something like that? He probably has his book here. About interactions between the European Christian devotees and the locals. And it just occurred to me this could be possibly a model, and then maybe something to extend and expand in this kind of research. The
yes.
kind of questions that he brought and so on.
Yeah, the book was The Hare Krishnas in India, I think.
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah, excellent anthropological work. Yeah, indeed. Could be some parallels as well. Yeah.
I was thinking you could also compare foreigners in other parts of India where they're heavily settled as well. Well, I don't know how heavily they are, but I remember when I was in Rishikesh and Haridwar, we were with like a tour guide, and so I saw quite a few European-looking people, and so I was wondering, what are they doing here?
Yeah.
And then I think his explanation was, well, they're Israelis here to smoke marijuana. But that's like, I'm sure they had like maybe something a little bit more than that as well. So that kind of comparison, why they're there, how long they're there for, what their project is, how people are receiving them.
Yes.
Can be quite,
yeah, that's a good idea.
In
yes.
like a spiritual center as well, especially, so it's quite somewhat similar, I think.
Yes. Oh, yes, I think this is a good point, because you will find, a number of foreigners who are residents, but then you find many, as this place is building up as a tourist attraction, basically, you will have more and more casual tourists coming there for a brief period of time. So it would be interesting to know where they're coming and what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yes? Do you find that the Western Hindus are given the same kind of status within Bengal? Are they, because our understanding generally is that they maybe don't take the whole package, they kind of pick and choose, as you were saying, they go there for sort of spiritual development or something like that, for very selfish reasons perhaps, and don't necessarily want to address the sort of cultural package which comes with those spiritual choices. And I wondered if that had a kind of knock-on effect for how they are perceived within Bengal more generally.
Yeah, it's there is a certain kind of divide necessarily between the foreigners and the Bengalis. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think the Bengali, in the urban areas, the Bengali, they're, at least in Calcutta, there is a very sophisticated middle class. They're English speaking. Sometimes you see them kind of approaching foreigners, trying to understand, the motives like that, where they're coming, where they're doing their transformation. In general, I've noticed there is a sense of respect for that. I guess it has to do with the globalization, the feeling that many people in India have, that the kind of adjusting to globalization and Western culture, it means in one sense giving up their own culture, compromising a sense of... And that is done with some sense of regret. Maybe it's unconscious. Maybe sometimes it's not really formulated. But seeing Westerners who many in Bengal interpret as those who are kind of have a high technological, come from a very maybe wealthy background, taking up their own culture and own tradition, at least their own spiritual tradition, it's encouraging. On the other side, many times these foreigners, at least in this kind of environments, they are not very much acquainted with the culture of Bengal, as you were saying. So although there is, in the communication, there is a sense of respect from at least the Bengali middle class, that relationship is not really complete, because there is an imbalance in understanding of the cultural, historical background in Bengal. So, I would say that, I don't know if that answered your question, but As I mentioned, middle-class Hindus in Bengal, I think they, Vaishnavas, they have very different reactions to the whole phenomenon, I would say. There's no, like, one. Those who are not Vaishnavas, as I said, they kind of look at this convert as a source of inspiration, perhaps, while others may be more critical in many ways. And there is a very strong secular movement in West Bengal because of the Communist Party for many, many years. And for them, the foreign presence has been seen as a threat, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's very variegated. The response that you may get there is variegated. But I would say among the Hindus, in general, it's more positive.
You mentioned Mamata Banerjee.
Banerjee, yes.
She was showing her respects to one of the Hare Krishna Swamis from the West.
Yes.
And that seems to be an interesting phenomenon. She is the chief minister of Bengal, and she's kind of offering pranam to a Western. He's, as I understand, he actually has Indian citizenship, which makes it even more interesting and complicated. Do you know, is she from a Vaishnava background?
I don't think so, but I got the impression that it has a Hindu background. She was doing the puja on that occasion, mm-hmm. and seems to be very comfortable and familiar with the whole ritual, what was going on ritually. Mm.
She's not a communist?
No, she's she's leading her own party, which is kind of maybe associated to the Congress Party. So she's kind of the successor of the CPM, of the Communist Party in West Bengal. I think the feeling in Bengal, at least from what I've seen, is that this shift of government has opened up many opportunities for religious development in Bengal, as the Communist Party was more kind of repressive of religious expressions. And I don't think there is any kind of very strong awareness that or discussion at the moment, at least, about the risk of that kind of revival in terms of communalism or religious conflicts that could arise. Mm-hmm. I see more like an optimism, like after so many years where religion was kind of kept in the backyard and was not really given any attention, there is an interest in putting religion again in the public space. With some kind of maybe diffidence, with an awareness that risks can also come, risk that communalism may again be revived. But there is a kind of optimism now, I feel, which I think the Prime Minister, the Chief Minister of Bengal also shows in her actions. What that will lead, what will be the consequences of it, and how the kind of religious openness that is taking place in Bengal, how that will develop is very hard to say. But there is a kind of opening up of religion at the moment.
Especially if the Muslim community is benefiting from the Hindu activity.
Yeah, exactly. There could be a kind of win-win situation somewhere. Yeah. If that is done, then I think the risk of tension can be averted. Mm. Yeah.
And also, Jaita Dakamaraj is kind of a particular swami in that he's fluent in Hindi, isn't it, and Bengali. He's travelled extensively, and he addresses not simply white audience. He doesn't belong to a white enclave, and he's very much part of the scene there. So I think he would probably have endeared himself to many because of that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Quite fluent in Bengali.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's not American.
Sorry?
And he's not American.
Oh, what is he?
Indian.
Indian.
it's actually a big difference.
Yeah. That's a big difference, right there.
He's American, he's CIA, isn't he?
But in the Indian perspective, they make very little distinction between Canadians and British, to say the truth.
Oh, Americans don't distinguish between Irish and British.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but point taken. Thank you.
And what's the Swedish response to the other side, to the broader kind of the white Swedish community? They're quite accepting of the new Hindu communities arising there.
In Sweden?
In Sweden, yes.
Yes, they are.
They're probably more tolerant of them than the sort of some like the Osho folk. Who would perhaps be on the edges of society.
Yes. I kind of observed the diaspora community in Sweden, the Hindu community, for quite some years. They're very well integrated. I think in terms of religion, I mean, Sweden is a very secular state. So the issues that I've been observing in the media has been mostly connected to Islam. And some or other, the Hindus have succeeded to keep a quite low profile and developing their own communities and trying really hard to integrate with the Swedish, learning the languages very quickly, entering the working force in a way that other communities haven't been able to do. Perhaps partially due to the fact that many of the diaspora Hindus are well educated, so they kind of very easily, while a lot of immigrants in Sweden are refugees, basically, and they're not very well educated. It takes many more years for them to enter the working force. The general image, I think, is quite positive, but there is a great ignorance in Sweden about Hinduism, what Hinduism is, at all levels. So there is a lot of work to do in terms of establishing education. Some of the foundational principles of how to understand Hinduism.
You want to say a few words about your book?
Oh, about this book. All right, so...
It's blue.
It's blue. And there is a white building pointing to the sky. Well, this is the one of the... one of the birthplaces of Chaitanya. As I mentioned, there are two in Mayapur, one of it in each side of the Ganges. So this is called the Yoga Pit, and so that's one of the on the Mayapur side. This is the kind of this more sacred place where Chaitanya is understood to be born. So the book is basically tracing the development of what has become the more widespread form of Vaishnavism in Bengal, which is the root of the Hare Krishna movement, but also of maybe 20 to 30 other movements. Some of them are international as well. And that movement goes back to a personality called Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, who was born in 1874. His father was a judge in the colonial administration, very well educated, both in in English and Western culture and philosophy and history, but also in traditional kind of Hindu or Indian knowledge. So he studied Sanskrit at the Sanskrit College and so on. And later founded the Gaudiya Math movement, which in 1918. What is making him a little interesting historically is that all of this happened in the colonial period, and he sent representative to London. He started the Gaudiya Mission in London in 1934, if I don't. He sent representatives to Berlin also during the Nazi period. So it's perhaps the first really articulated attempt by this Bengali Vaishnavas from Calcutta to approach Europe. So it's a kind of predecessor to what will come later on. So that's more or less. And theologically, it's interesting because... the way I approach this study is that, as I mentioned also in the beginning of this presentation, that there is a certain kind of turn in the 19th century within modern Hinduism in Bengal as it's taking shape through personalities like Ram Mohan Roy, later Swami Vivekananda, and others, toward Advaita Vedanta, which was not really very well studied in Bengal before, but it was introduced by these middle-class intellectuals. And influenced the Brahmo Samaj and many other religious movements. While here we have a kind of counter movement to that, pointing back to what is the more Bengali theology of bhakti, of Vedanta dualism. So it's a, I look at it in a kind of a counter movement, counter culture, counter theology, in that sense. They try to resist the mainstream Advaitin Vedanta that becomes gradually more and more established. Mm-hmm. That's also what it makes it interesting. It's like deconstructing, in one sense, the monolithic idea of what modern Hinduism is theologically, and presenting other alternatives. One of others, among others, I would say, but a prominent one. Mm.
So. Well, thank you, Dr. Sardella, for a very interesting talk that you know, has great contemporary relevance, really. You told us about what's going on now, which is quite nice, you know, instead of me going on about history or something. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your attention.